From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, how this long, cold, harsh winter is or is not affecting Wisconsin's fish population.
Later, the author of a new novel imagining the Happy Days characters as real people isn't so much an homage to the show as it is a tribute to our younger selves.
That's the fun part of the book, is sort of remembering yourself watching the show and sort of what your life was like back then. You're remembering your own childhood. That was part of the project, was reintroducing those memories to our lives.
The female-led band Sabra and Carlisle is hoping to change the gender makeup of Milwaukee's music scene, both on stage and behind the scenes.
I feel like there's a lot of women that I've met, that I network with, that we play shows together. So that's progress, but I think like the next level is getting more women behind the soundboards and booking the shows.
And we'll have the latest edition of Bubbler Talk. Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. If you're paying close attention to the calendar, you'd believe that we're into the last couple of weeks of winter. But looking outside, it's hard to reconcile that idea with the weather that we are currently experiencing.
Northern Wisconsin in particular remains heavily blanketed in snow. That includes the hundreds of lakes which are covered with both snow and ice. Below the ice are thousands of fish which rely on oxygen to survive. So how are they faring? Will they survive this seemingly endless winter?
Mike Vogelzang is optimistic that most fish will come through just fine. He's the North District Fisheries Supervisor with the Wisconsin DNR, which is based in Woodruff, Wisconsin. When Vogelzang talked with Lake Effect Susan Bentz earlier this week, he said his neck of the woods had received 2 feet of snow in recent days. But Vogelzang says heavy storms in early winter are really more dangerous to fish.
There's a lot of winters where we've had heavy dumpings of snow early in the season in December and in through January. In those years, we want to be particularly cautious about going out and monitoring dissolved oxygen on some of these shallower lakes. The good news with this winter is all the real heavy snow came late, and prior to that, we had very little snow cover on the ice, so that helped the plants and the water generate oxygen. So really, even with the heavy snow we've seen recently, I don't expect we're going to have too many oxygen issues on most of our waters.
So you told me that in Vilas County alone, there's just gobs and gobs of lakes. And so is that the county that you are paying closest attention to, or are you monitoring throughout the northern Wisconsin area?
Correct. In northern Wisconsin, we're more or less a district. So the northern quarter of the state is one whole district that I oversee. Yeah, we're going to be watching this from east to west, north to south, and we have a couple of dozen lakes that typically have a partial kill just about every year. So those, there's really no surprises there. We typically go out and do some dissolved oxygen monitoring, so at least we know how severe or not severe that kill may be. And usually we start doing that monitoring about the middle part of March, so we can at least give folks a heads up that, yes, you're going to probably see some dead fish or not.
So is there a common thread in those lakes where you said it is not uncommon to have fish die off or fish kill during the winter?
The usual suspect lakes are typically smaller in size, definitely less than 500 acres, and a maximum depth of 15 feet or less. And typically they're a swampier, lower-lying lake, you know, with real dark water. And if you have those traits, typically you can expect to see some partial winter kills. And I know people panic sometimes when they hear the word winter kill, because they maybe envision that the whole lake is going to die and all the fish are going to suffocate, when in reality, it's just nature's way of kind of thinning the herd. So we never, ever see a total kill in these waters. It's just enough to kind of thin that population out. And typically, we don't do much management action in those, because the fish that are remaining, they will repopulate themselves. And in fact, one of the benefits of a partial winter kill is that it increases the growing space in those lakes. And for the following 3 or 4 years after a partial kill, you can have some really, really good fishing, because those fish typically grow in size at a very quick rate.
When you do begin to have some snow melt, your team will be going out to drill into them and see what the dissolved oxygen situation is?
Right. And typically on the lakes that we suspect we may see a partial kill on, and we've got a list because we've been at this for quite a while, we kind of know the couple of dozen lakes or so in the north that are going to kill typically every year. So we'll go out on a few of those, and we'll drill holes in four or five locations around the lake. So we're looking down in the deep hole, the shallow areas, and in some random spots. And we'll drop a dissolved oxygen probe down every foot, and we'll take an oxygen reading every foot all the way down to the bottom. And then we can develop a dissolved oxygen profile from that and just give us an idea how much oxygen is left in that body of water. And it gives us a pretty good idea whether or not that lake is going to kill or not that year.
So when you do that testing, are you checking dissolved oxygen exclusively, or do you check out anything else?
We check primarily for dissolved oxygen. Mm-hmm. The probes do have the ability sometimes to take pH and temperature and things like that, but it's primarily the dissolved oxygen we're looking at this time of year.
Because Wisconsin is blessed with so many lakes, you categorize the types of lake and you do ongoing testing of each of those six types. Is that right?
Right. We've got a suite of lakes across the north that we call them trend lakes. And because it's a trend lake, we get to survey those lakes every 3 years or so. So we've got a really long data set on these waters. And of the trend lakes we have, they're set up to mimic or subsample the variety of lakes that we have. So one of our trend lakes is a shallower, more fertile system. Some of our other trend lakes are larger, deeper waters, and they're designed to basically represent the thousands of lakes that we have across the north. So what's happening in the trend water, you know, we can extrapolate that to see what might be going on in the thousands of other lakes that we potentially can't sample.
So why every 3 years or so versus every year? Is it just cost and staff prohibitive?
Yeah, a little bit on the cost, but really year to year we don't see really measurable changes in these waters. So if we go every 3 years, you know, that gives that water body a chance to change enough, if it's going to, that we can actually pick up on that change and measure it. In some of these waters, we could probably even sample them a little bit less infrequently, because we're talking about 20 and 30 year trends here. Slow changes over time. Luckily, we aren't seeing any dramatic changes in our waters up here year to year.
When you're considering the health of our state's lakes and, you know, obviously the life in them, fish and everything else, what are some of the challenges that you're tuned into that, you know, that people should be aware of?
Sure. The big challenges are we see a lot of variability year to year. And what you have to do is kind of smooth out that variability and determine what that trend is. For example, a walleye population, it might be very, very high 1 year, and the next year, half of what it was. But then the next year may bounce up again. So it's this roller coaster effect. And our big challenge is trying to see what the average is or what the trend is. And unfortunately, we don't see those trends until you sample a lake over the course of maybe a decade or 15 years. If we reacted to every little change we saw every year, it would be just about impossible to do a real successful job at managing these waters.
We talked about the snow coming late in the season this year. There are times where there's heavy rains that may be unanticipated or drought. All of those things are influencing what's going on in the lakes. Do you see trends on the extreme side, or do you see it as being a roller coaster that you'd anticipate?
Right. I recall in the mid-2000s, we had a drought that lasted for about 8 or 9 years, and water levels were at all-time lows. We had trees actually growing out into the lake bed on a number of our waters. And now over the last 4 or 5 years, we've kind of gone the other way and, you know, seen record rainfall. We've had lots of snows the last few years. And now lakes are pretty much right where they were normally. And those trees are flooded now. And it's providing really good habitat for the fish, at least for now. And eventually those trees are going to drown and fall into the water and continue providing habitat for fish. But Yeah, we went from drought to now the other extreme where our lakes are completely full again. And based on this winter and how wet it's been the last couple of seasons, I would say we're going to continue on that trend for a while. But yeah, it seems like it's kind of a low and a high, and things are constantly changing.
So anything else you want people in southeastern Wisconsin to know about their lakes in the north?
Yeah, just, you know, reiterate again, you know, luckily all the heavy snow came late this year. So I don't think it's going to be as harsh of an impact as if we would have had this in December or January, because we will be experiencing a thaw here in the next couple of weeks. And, you know, we'll start to see some runoff going into the lakes, and just a little bit of a trickle from melting snow gives the lakes an oxygen boost. So it's not to say we will avoid winter kill altogether, but like I said, in those usual suspect lakes, we're probably going to see some, just like we always do. But to say it's going to be a horrible year because of all the snow, I'm going to bank on not, just because the snow came late.
Mike Vogelsang is the North District Fisheries Supervisor with the Wisconsin DNR based in Woodruff. He spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz.
We'll take a quick break, and then a new novel featuring some old characters. What if the Happy Days characters were real people who existed in the real world of 1980s Milwaukee? We'll talk about that intriguing prospect next on Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM.
Back now with more of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Plenty of TV shows and movies over the years have been the subject of fan fiction, and many of those adaptations take the characters as they are and place them in plot lines their original creators never dreamed of. James Boyce's new novel is not exactly that kind of fan fiction.
Who Killed the Fonz places the characters from the iconic Milwaukee-based sitcom Happy Days a couple of decades after the series ended its run. It imagines Richie Cunningham, Patsy Weber, Ralph Malph, and others existing in the real world of the 1980s following a tragic motorcycle accident on the Hone Bridge. The book is set in a somewhat fictionalized version of Milwaukee, far from the real world of Jersey City, where we reach the author by phone. James Boyce, welcome to the program.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So why was Happy Days the show that inspired you to get going down this road and write this book?
A few reasons. Happy Days, it has its own place kind of in our culture. We sort of know the world. We know the characters. Everybody knows Fonzie. It's sort of an iconic piece of American culture. But the interesting part about Happy Days is not many people really know that many or remember that many details about Happy Days. We kind of, you know, there's a few plot lines, I guess, but over the course of 10 years, the plot lines kind of fall away and the details of certain elements of the show fall away. What you're left with is an iconic character in Fonzie and this memory of this world that is full of nostalgic virtue and it's sort of a happy place to return to. It's almost a misremembered past. It's sort of a version of a time and place in America that never really existed, but that doesn't really matter to us because we enjoy the memory of it anyway, the sort of imagined memory. And then we sort of carry that pleasant feeling with us as we remember ourselves watching the show and go forth from there.
I was just gonna ask that, whether our memories of the show are as much about our memories of ourselves as they were about the show itself.
I think that's exactly right. The fun part of the book is sort of remembering yourself watching the show and sort of what your life was like back then. You're remembering your own childhood. That was part of the project was reintroducing those memories to our lives.
Well, and I don't know whether you want to cop to how old you are, but do you remember watching Happy Days in first runs or reruns?
No, it was reruns. It was and then to sort of write this book, it was sort of going back and looking at YouTube and online summaries of episodes, so seeing the sort of third removed Happy Days experience. You know, you're sort of reading these cataloged summaries of this TV show that the the cataloger on the website probably watched in reruns too. So you're getting this sort of prism effect. And then so that is really compelling to me as a sort of working with this piece of kind of appropriated pop culture.
You know, without giving too much away, give us a quick thumbnail sketch of where these characters, where you believed these characters or decided these characters had gone since their run on ABC ended.
Well, we sort of had an indication based on the end of the TV series. The last episode, Richie says goodbye to Fonzie, and he's going to Hollywood to make it as a screenwriter. That's kind of how we leave Richie Cunningham. If you sort of draw an extension from that, he goes to Hollywood right when the 70s is starting to happen. If we're working from the timeline of the TV series, so you can picture him there with the new Hollywood kind of movement happening, where we have Spielberg and George Lucas and the auteurs starting to take over Hollywood. So how's this wholesome Mr. Everybody's Favorite Son kind of fit into that when the Hollywood culture is working in shades of gray and moral ambiguity? He's a smart, sort of cultured, intelligent writer. He has, you know, strong principles and ethics. And so I think he would probably fit in pretty well there.
But of course he has to rename himself Richard.
Exactly. Nobody wants to take a meeting with a kid named Richie from Milwaukee. he has to gussy himself up a little bit. He has to develop kind of pretensions and a facade of sorts to survive out in Hollywood. And what he has sort of turned himself into to do what his dream is, it transforms him. And when he comes back to Milwaukee 20 years later, he's unrecognizable, and it's alienating to those he left, who haven't been out there in Hollywood and don't understand why he has become like he has. And part of the book is him dealing with that and coming to terms with who he has become, who he used to be, who he's going to be. And his friends and loved ones sort of reacting to that and coming to terms with that as well.
Right, because back into Milwaukee, he kind of parachutes for Fonzie's funeral. I don't know that we're giving too much away because the title of the book is Who Killed the Fonz, but he encounters Potsy and Ralph Malph, who have changed very little.
They've changed very little. They've stayed in Milwaukee, and they've had families and taken local jobs and are sort of living the life that they're on track for when he left them. So he's gone one way, they've gone another way. And a lot of the story is sort of reconciling that gulf between these old friends.
Right. You know, and of course, some of this is, I think the timeline is a little complicated because the show was set in the 50s. But of course, it really transpired in the 1970s and 80s. Did that complicate things at all for you? Because a lot of what took place in the show did so really with kind of 1970s sensibilities.
Exactly. It was sort of thread the needle in terms of tone and voice. You know, it would have been fun to kind of play, get very meta with it and have him sort of rubbing shoulders with, this young filmmaker named Ron Howard or something. getting very very bizarre with it. He could be watching Happy Days or something. You know, sort of toyed around with these ideas. But the project turned out to be capturing the voice of the show and adding literary value to the show, to the voice. Sort of taking this ephemeral piece of television and sort of trying to elevate it into something with substance, with literary value.
And still sort of maintaining that kind of inherent sweetness that existed in the show and with the characters.
That was really important, which we sort of realized drafting and sort of working on it, was how important that was. Once you took that out, the thing, it just sort of fell apart and wasn't Happy Days anymore and wasn't really anything that we remembered. We definitely learned sort of the importance of the sweetness.
There's, of course, a mystery in this book, but really it seems like at the heart of things, you're exploring the nature of friendship, really.
Exactly. The theme of the book, I think, is the nature of friendship. What happens as we grow up and grow apart geographically or, you know, spiritually or other ways? What happens to those friendships? And do those friendships still have value? And do they serve us? And how do we sort of bring those on and as we go forward? One of the most iconic friendships in Happy Days in American culture, I guess, is Fonzie and Richie Cunningham. We sort of grew up with Happy Days, and we sort of grew apart from Happy Days as we grew up. And Richie grew up with Fonzie, and he grew apart from Fonzie as he grew up. We grow apart from our past, sort of as a culture. What do we do with that past that we sort of are still dragging around kind of behind us? It hasn't really gone anywhere. It's still there. So how do we reconcile it? And how does it serve us? And how do we serve it?
Well, and it seems like the era in which you set this book is key, because any later and you get into the social media era, and it seems like friendship might have been a different animal if, you know, they had been able to track each other down over Facebook or Instagram.
It would have been a lot shorter book. it does make you sort of look at our current situations with how we communicate and connect with each other, and give ourselves kind of a gut check about, are we really connecting with people, and is there more connecting we can do? Are we content to have these sort of tenuous digital connections, or, you know, is there a greater value to be had by going a little bit further and really connecting on a deeper level with people?
Maybe this gets heavier than we want to, but in some ways this book and using Happy Days, this is kind of a metaphor for our younger selves as people or even as a culture.
Yeah, that's definitely how I saw it as I was working on it. And that was definitely the goal, was to kind of explore that. I think that's kind of what makes it literature, is exploring that kind of idea. It gets to the sort of the human experience. That's a vital part of it, growing, changing. So taking something that's, you know, seen as kind of this kind of goofy, lowbrow thing, an old TV show, and sort of exploring that sort of fuller aspect of it, that's really what sort of motivated the project and pushed it forward.
At the same time, it had to be something of a delicious exercise to take these characters who, you know, already existed in our, you know, in our sort of collective imagination, and do this hypothetical with them.
Yeah, it was delicious fun. It's appropriation art.
Do you have qualms about that as a writer?
No, it's interesting to me. I'm a fan of appropriation artists, folks like Warhol or Richard Prince. Yeah, that's exciting to me, because, you know, I can get heady about it, but I think culture is so dominant in our lives that our relationship to it has value in exploring and portraying in art and literature. So playing with that was pretty meaty and juicy and just fun. You know, a lot of this book is fun. It's not more fun than other books I've done. Other books I've done are very, very tend to be, you know, gritty realism, I guess would be the way to put it. But this is a fun, page-turning novel.
Well, and I have to say, some of the most enjoyable parts of the book are when Richie or Richard is talking with his, you know, very stereotypical Hollywood agent, you know, who's brought in this money from, I forget where the producer is from, but they want to produce this knockoff of Star Wars, and just imagining this conversation that's going on between, you know, the Richie we know and sort of the Hollywood shark agent.
Right. He's at the moment where they're, you know, they're asking him to betray his values, his principles. He's in the crass 1980s in Hollywood, where it's all blockbusters and box office, and he's trying to stick to his guns as an auteur and and a serious filmmaker being put into this position now where it's either go in this crass direction from this these people you don't respect and don't care for their violent tastes, or have nothing, basically, and because the project's not going to go forward unless he takes this project. It's his only option. So sort of navigating those decisions, that's kind of sort of the experience that was especially juicy to explore. That's a real human kind of moment where he's being asked to compromise. You know, we compromise a lot in our lives. As we get older, we compromise. So having him forced to compromise in this way, it really shows sort of how far he's come from the Milwaukee of his youth that he remembers the pleasant oasis.
One is tempted to say that he is reluctant to jump the shark.
He is absolutely reluctant to jump the shark, which is in the it's in the book, by the way.
Yes, it is.
It's not how Fonzie dies.
Was, you know, speaking along these lines, though, you know, when we think about, because I think Richie has been trying to pitch, what is it, a Cormac McCarthy story to make his film?
He's gotten really into this Cormac McCarthy novel, Sutri.
Right.
It's a very dense, obscure novel, and he's trying to push it through crass 1980s blockbuster Hollywood.
What was it like for you to pitch this novel?
This novel was it's interesting. The origins of it were sort of interesting. Simon Schuster was interested in writing and taking Happy Days, the property, and turning it into a novel. And they asked me if I would be interested in that. So we had to sort of create an outline. We had to sort of develop it. And then we had to get approval from the copyright holders of the intellectual property of Happy Days, which is the CBS Corporation these days. And so there was a... interesting component of this, which was working in compliance with this corporate entity, and working inside those confines added a whole new kind of aspect and sort of limiting but fun, freeing in a lot of ways, restricting in other ways, kind of component to it.
I note you do not have any blurbs from any of the actors involved in Happy Days, however.
Yeah, well, it was funny. We tried to get one from Henry Winkler, but his management folks were very adamant about not giving him anything related to Happy Days.
Because he's involved in enough other TV shows now, and he is a novelist himself. So,
yeah, he's an accomplished children's book author.
Yeah,
but hopefully, I don't know. Maybe he'll find it, and maybe he'll see that it's a serious-minded kind of effort and. And take a look at it.
It'd be something to spot him at an airport reading this book.
Here's open.
Well, listen, James Boyce, I enjoyed it a lot. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk about it.
It was my pleasure.
James Boyce is the author of the new novel Who Killed the Fonz, as well as four previous novels. He's also an occasional contributor to publications such as Esquire, Salon, and McSweeney's. We reached him on the line from New Jersey.
Another break now, and then we'll be joined in Studio C1 by the Milwaukee band Sabra and Carlisle for an in-studio performance and conversation. Keep listening. That's next on Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. The Milwaukee band Sabra and Carlisle see themselves as an outlier in a music scene that's often dominated by men. Lead singer Sabra Lakin is hoping to change that with more women-led shows like their upcoming event at Club Garibaldi.
The event, titled Celebration, is honoring heroines in the art, and donations will benefit Planned Parenthood. It will include performances by a number of women-led bands, including Sabra and Carlisle. The group joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers in studio to talk about their music, their upcoming show, and to perform, including this song titled Rabbit Hole.
Rabbit Hole by Sabra and Carlisle. Thank you all so much for joining us here in studio.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So before we started recording, I was just told that this is one of the first times you've actually all played together, all these four musicians in studio.
Yes, very first time.
Yeah.
We have our new bass player, Mary.
Hi, everybody. This is my first show. Carlisle.
Well, thanks for having it here with us.
Yes.
So you just started adding in all of the pieces of this band. For a long time, you guys were just a duo.
Yes, we started out as a two-piece back in September of 2017. Yeah, and just slowly grew our way into our final form right now, so the four-piece. But so our drummer's other band, King Eye and the Squirts, we're longtime friends, and he started playing bass for us because he wanted to record us, and he was like, you need to fill out this sound. He brought Jesse in, and then we got to record a little bit, and then he decided to go, so then we had room for a bass, and he stayed with us, and then we got to add Mary.
Nice. You've all played, I know, in bands before throughout the area. What makes this unique? What makes Sabre and Carlisle different from those other bands?
I think it's like a sound that I haven't really heard yet in the scene. I feel like it's a good mixture of the past and future rock and roll to have this present sound. And such high energy, like female frontedness and like what we're bringing to the table is pretty exciting. So
I would agree with that. I mean, the first time I heard Sabre and Carlisle, I was driving in my car and they were playing on 88.9, the song we just played, actually, Rabbit Hole. And I was like, who is this? And I couldn't decide if it was an older band or if it was somebody that was contemporary. And then I found out it was Sabre and Carlisle, and it blew my mind. So I was very excited when they asked me to play bass.
You know, I've heard you actually in other interviews describe your music as a kind of apocalyptic Western. And I read that before actually listening to your music, and I was like, oh, okay, this is going to be like bluegrass. It's going to be like, I don't know, you know, slower Western music somehow. How do you kind of describe your music, and do you think of it in terms of a genre?
I don't know if I do. Do you?
Well, it's always hard to like describe your own music, but for us, when we were in the beginning, us talking about apocalyptic Western, like there is, like we're very inspired by like spaghetti Western kind of sounds and surf sounds, and so you know, all of our songs are that I write are about revolution and the world that I see for us in the future. Obviously, the way the country is going now, we need to change some things. So when I say apocalyptic Western, it's just kind of having that feeling of having a revolution and a new frontier and bringing that sound back to everything. So
bringing it back to everything and bringing it back to Milwaukee.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, with that in mind, as all Milwaukee musicians, I think this is a question we ask a lot of local bands, but one that remains, you know, I don't know if contentious is the right word, but I think everyone has their own perspective on it. What do you think of the Milwaukee music scene in general? How has it changed since you started in Milwaukee, and where do you think it's going?
It's about the same.
I don't think it's the same. I mean, I don't think it's the same because, like, starting, it is very male-dominated. It's hugely male-dominated, and it's hard to bust up those bills, right?
Yeah.
But I think that's changing now, just like the world is changing. You know, like there's not many female fronted bands in Milwaukee that I can think of other than like your band. I don't know if I can say this on the radio. Your band with Rachel.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. I mean, and like the Flips and like
Foxface.
And Foxface, yeah. And everything like that. So there were, I feel like there's more female fronted bands now, or more, you know, femme-identifying groups coming out and stuff like that, whereas in the past it wasn't really like that. So we're kind of seeing the end of that wave and a new wave coming out in this scene. So
when you say a bill, what do you mean?
A bill as far as like the shows we're seeing, you know, like the community, the music scene of what we're seeing all the time, the bills are the shows that are being put on.
Okay.
It's all pretty much male bands.
I think that there's a lot more female musicians that are playing than when I first moved to Milwaukee 13 years ago. And I was trying to get something going, but I like needed my boyfriend to help me, you know, at the time to get it off the ground. But now I feel like there's a lot of women that I've met, that I network with, that we play shows together. So that's progress. But I think like the next level is getting more women behind the soundboards and booking the shows, because that's the thing is I think still a lot of the work is falling on women to drive our shows where we are on the bills. And I think if we can get more of our perspective behind the other institutions of power within the music scene, then I think maybe we can reach our vision, hopefully our revolution vision.
So we're going to talk more about that in just a bit, but you have another song for us, Wild at Heart.
Yes, that's going to be the name of our full-length album as well, and the starring song on that. We'll be right back.
Wild at Heart by Sabra and Carlisle. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you for having us.
So you mentioned just before you played Wild at Heart, not just the name of the song, but also the name of your full-length album, which will be out this summer. You also have an EP that's coming out before then.
Yes. We should describe it as a split single. We're having it with Abby Jean for Record Store Day. There'll be a song per side, and that will be released on April 13th with her. She has one side, and then we have the other, which we'll play a little bit later for you.
Another female-led group.
Yes.
Or artist, I suppose.
Yes. The extraordinary Abby Jean, who's kind of taken us under her wing and let us fly with her. We got to open for her at Turner Hall for her show there, and that was just amazing. We couldn't have imagined, you know, starting out last September to practicing in a freezing room and then months later going to a packed Turner Hall, because she used to hear us practicing every day. Hi-Fi Cafe is like her place where she hangs, you know, and I lived above there at the time, and me and Carlisle were practicing as the two-piece, and she would hear us practicing, and then she saw how hard we worked and then just started taking us under her wing so we could fly with her.
Nice female artist supporting other.
Extremely. Her willpower and strength in this music scene and like guiding me and telling me everything that she's learned is amazing, because you don't find that too often where, you know, artists will share with you like that.
Nice. I know you have an event coming up at Club Garibaldi called Celebration, and it's really honoring, you know, heroines, women in the arts. What do you think are the benefits of an event that really focuses on women and their contributions to the arts, particularly in a city like Milwaukee, which, as you mentioned, has a music scene that is largely dominated by men?
The whole opus of the benefit came from our drummer, Jesse. So March 9th is his birthday. Last year, his last band put on a fest called Jesse Fest, and it was all about him and his birthday. And this year he was like, I don't want to do that. I want to offer a platform for people other than me. And, you know, we just decided it was the right time to, like, bring together all these female artists, not only painters and musicians and DJs and just, you know, everything that we could think of, to give them the stage. We like the fact that we can give this platform to females and to women like this, but eventually, too, we'd like to move on and just have it all be integrated. So this is the first step of giving the platform to women. Okay, it's your turn to, you know, dominate this scene, right? And then next step is all of us to be together, diverse.
So when you were starting out as a band, who were some of the, you know, female-led bands or just musicians more generally who you really looked to when creating your sound?
Shannon Shaw of Shannon and the Clams is probably the most powerful female vocalist of our generation, in my opinion. We got to play with her. I got to open for her as an acoustic player 10 years ago on her first tour with Shannon the Clams. And ever since then, she's just kind of like kept me in the loop. And I just look up to her because she tirelessly paves her way through extraordinary situations. Like the last time we saw her in Madison, after she got done playing, she had men come up to her and tell her what bass she needed to play or like what instrument she would make her sound better. So she, even after a decade of like giving her all, is still getting flack. Right? And still perseveres and handles the situation with like grace and aplomb and just still continues to be the best in her field. And that's what guided me to like doing what I felt passionate about.
Is that something that both of you, we're looking at a band that's about 50-50 men and women, but is that something that both of you, Saber and Mary, have dealt with when you play?
Yeah, all the time. I mean, a lot of what happens is, you know, we'll arrive at a show, we're loading in gear, and it's instantly mistaken that we're the girlfriends or, you know, the roadies. We're not actually playing in the band. Last summer, my other band, Foxface, was going to play a show, and we have three women in the front, and we had to submit, like, a stage plot ahead of time. We had to submit all of our details for the show to the sound people. And we showed up and we were having a very confusing conversation about where we were supposed to be on stage, because the whole time they thought that the three of us were backup singers and that there was more of the band. And then we had to explicitly say, we are the musicians. We're playing. And it was like you saw this light bulb go off in their head. Oh, we made an assumption. And I could not believe that that still happened.
Even today, telling my mom's boyfriend that I have a female bass player in the band now, he was like, what? Females play bass? It's like, yes, we play all instruments. We do all things.
We have two hands.
Yes. And a brain. Can you believe it?
So you have another song for us, 1, 2, 3, 4. Any information about this song?
Yes. So this song will be the song on the split single with Abby Jean, available record store day April 13th. So, and you're hearing it here first. So
great. Well, before you play, thank you all so much for joining us in studio.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Milwaukee-based band Sabra and Carlisle features Sabra Lakin on vocals, Carlisle Nowak on guitar, Jesse Buskoff on drums, and Mary Joy Hickey on bass.
The group will play tomorrow night at Club Garibaldi in Bayview for an event called Celebration, honoring heroines in the arts. Donations to the event will benefit Planned Parenthood, and there is more information at WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break, and then Bubbler Talk shares the story of an iconic food stand on Milwaukee's East Side. That's when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. It's Lake Effect on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm Marty Michelson. A listener asked us, I drive past Chubby's on the corner of Oakland and North nearly every day. What is the story behind this iconic little food stand? I decided to find out as I also pass the drive-thru almost daily. The tiny stand is located on one of the busiest corners of Milwaukee's East Side, Oakland and North. It sits in the corner of a parking lot, and on top of it is a sign that simply reads, The Drive-Thru.
What kind of bagels would you like those on? Plain? Okay, anything else?
On a recent chilly Saturday morning, Shivani Henderson drove up to the window and ordered breakfast. She sat in her car waiting for bacon and eggs. Only a couple cars can be in line at one time because the shop is wedged into such a small space. Henderson says she's lived in Milwaukee her whole life and has been frequenting the drive-thru for about 5 years.
I remember coming here one time when I was pregnant with my son. That was my first time having it. My best friend brought me down here. It's about 1:30 in the morning.
Henderson says she loves the food and especially likes coming here late at night. The place is open until 2 a.m. during the week and 3 a.m. on the weekends. Another customer, Marie Sanders, says she drove up from Chicago to visit some friends in Milwaukee, and they recommended the place.
I like the vibe. Yeah. I don't think there's any place in Chicago like this, so this is, like, new.
Sanders ordered the signature item on the menu, the freshly made mini donuts. Inside the food stand, a worker feeds a butter mixture into a machine that cranks out a dozen donuts and places them in a fryer. The mini donuts are served warm, sprinkled with sugar, and they melt in your mouth. I know this because I sampled a few while I was there. While they're the most popular item, the menu is extensive and includes sloppy joes, nachos, and hand-dipped milkshakes. Jessica Meyer manages Chubby's restaurant on the other side of the parking lot from the drive-thru. She says the little place has been around since the 1980s. First, it was a stand where people could drop off film to have it developed. Then a new owner turned the space into a drive-thru.
It got converted into the little mini donut shop, and there was the owner of that decided not to renew their lease. Chubby's was already here at that time, so we decided to kind of take it over.
Meyer says the drive-thru serves about 100 people per day. She estimates that 90% of the orders are for the mini donuts. She says they've proven to be such a crowd pleaser that Chubby's is now serving them at two of its restaurants in other parts of town. But as for opening additional tiny drive-ups...
As far as expanding to do another just donut shop, I'm not sure, because this is kind of a little icon here, you know, and I don't know that we'd get that same traffic if it was popping up new somewhere.
Meyer says customers have memories of visiting this little corner of the east side for the tasty treats, and she doesn't want to tamper with tradition. Marty Michelson, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
What have you always wanted to know about Milwaukee's people, places, or culture? Visit WUWM.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Bonnie and I produce the show along with Joy Powers and Audrey Nowakowski, assistant producer Maddie Andre, and intern Zoe Munson. We get additional support from digital producer Lauren Sigfusson and the WUWM news team, including Susan Bentz this week.
Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It's 11 o'clock, and keep listening. Fresh Air is next.